5 minutes in the station at Marseille, and the American lady bought a copy of the Daily Mail and a half bottle of Evian water. She walked a little way along the station platform, but she stayed near the steps of the car, because at Cannes, where it stopped for 12 minutes, the train had left with no signal of departure, and she had only gotten on just in time. The American lady was a little deaf, and she was afraid that perhaps signals of departure were given and that she did not hear them. The train left the station in Marseille, and there was not only the switchyards and the factory smoke, but looking back, the town of Marseille, and the harbor with stone hills behind it, and the last of the sun on the water. As it was getting dark, the train passed a farmhouse burning in a field. Motor cars were stopped along the road, and bedding and things from inside the farmhouse were spread in the field. Many people were watching the house burn. After it was dark, the train was in Avignon. People got on and off. At the newsstand, Frenchmen returning to Paris bought that day's French papers. On the station platform were Negro soldiers. They wore brown uniforms and were tall, and their faces shone close under the electric light. Their faces were very black, and they were too tall to stare. The train left Avignon station with the Negroes standing there. A short white sergeant was with them. Inside the Lee Salon compartment, the porter had pulled down the 3 beds from inside the wall and prepared them for sleeping. In the night, the American lady lay without sleeping because the train was a rapide and went very fast, and she was afraid of the speed in the night. The American lady's bed was the one next to the window. The canary from Palermo, a cloth spread over his cage, was out of the draft in the corridor that went into the compartment washroom. There was a blue light outside the compartment, and all night the train went very fast, and the American lady lay awake and waited for a wreck. In the morning, the train was near Paris, and after the American lady had come out from the washroom, looking very wholesome and middle-aged and American in spite of not having slept, and had taken the cloth off the birdcage and hung the cage in the sun, she went back to the restaurant car for breakfast. When she came back to the Lee Salon compartment again, the beds had been pushed back into the wall and made into seats. The canary was shaking his feathers in the sunlight that came through the open window, and the train was much nearer Paris.
"He loves the sun," the American lady said. "He'll sing now in a little while."
The canary shook his feathers and pecked into them.
"I've always loved birds," the American lady said. "I'm taking him home to my little girl." "There, he's singing now."
The canary chirped and the feathers on his throat stood out. Then he dropped his bill and pecked into his feathers again. The train crossed a river and passed through a very carefully tended forest. The train passed through many outside of Paris towns. There were tram cars in the towns and big advertisements for the Belle Jardiniere and Dubonnet and Pernod on the walls toward the train. All that the train passed through looked as though it were for breakfast. For several minutes I had not listened to the American lady, who was talking to my wife.
"Is your husband American too?" asked the lady. "Yes," said my wife. "We're both Americans." "I thought you were English." "Oh, no."
"Perhaps that was because I wore braces," I said. I had started to say suspenders and changed it to braces in the mouth to keep my English character. The American lady did not hear. She was really quite deaf. She read lips, and I had not looked toward her. I had looked out of the window. She went on talking to my wife.
"I'm so glad you're Americans. American men make the best husbands," the American lady was saying. "That was why we left the continent, you know. My daughter fell in love with a man in Vevey." She stopped. "They were simply madly in love." She stopped again. "I took her away, of course." "Did she get over it?" asked my wife. "I don't think so," said the American lady. "She wouldn't eat anything, and she wouldn't sleep at all. I've tried so very hard, but she doesn't seem to take an interest in anything. She doesn't care about things. I couldn't have her marrying a foreigner." She paused. "Someone, a very good friend, once told me, no foreigner can make an American girl a good husband."
"No," said my wife. "I suppose not." The American lady admired my wife's traveling coat.
And it turned out that the American lady had bought her own clothes for 20 years now from the same Maison de Couturier in the Rue Saint-Honoré. They had her measurements, and a vendeuse who knew her and her tastes picked the dresses out for her, and they were sent to America. They came to the post office near where she lived uptown in New York, and the duty was never exorbitant because they opened the dresses there in the post office to appraise them, and they were always very simple-looking, with no gold lace nor ornaments that would make the dresses look expensive. Before the present vendeuse, named Thérèse, there had been another vendeuse named Amélie. Altogether, there had only been these two in the 20 years. It had always been the same couturier. Prices, however, had gone up. The exchange, though, equalized that. They had her daughter's measurements now, too. She was grown up, and there was not much chance of their changing now. The train was now coming into Paris. The fortifications were leveled, but grass had not grown. There were many cars standing on tracks. Brown wooden restaurant cars and brown wooden sleeping cars that would go to Italy at 5 o'clock that night, if that train still left at 5. The cars were marked Paris-Rome, and the cars with seats on the roofs that went back and forth to the suburbs with, at certain hours, people in all the seats and on the roofs, if that were the way it were still done, and passing were the white walls and many windows of houses. Nothing had eaten any breakfast.
"Americans make the best husbands," the American lady said to my wife.
I was getting down the bags.
"American men are the only men in the world to marry." "How long ago did you leave Vevey?"
asked my wife.
2 years ago this fall. It's her, you know, that I'm taking the canary to."
"Was the man your daughter was in love with a Swiss?"
"Yes," said the American lady. "He was from a very good family in Vevey. He was going to be an engineer. They met there in Vevey. They used to go on long walks together."
"I know Vevey," said my wife. "We were there on our honeymoon."
"Were you really? That must have been lovely. I had no idea, of course, that she'd fall in love with him."
"It was a very lovely place," said my wife.
"Yes," said the American lady. "Isn't it lovely? Where did you stop there?"
"We stayed at the Trois Couronnes," said my wife.
"It's such a fine old hotel," said the American lady.
"Yes," said my wife. "We had a very fine room, and in the fall the country was lovely."
"Were you there in the fall?"
"Yes," said my wife. We were passing three cars that had been in a wreck. They were splintered open and the roof sagged in. "Look," I said, "there's been a wreck." The American lady looked and saw the last car.
"I was afraid of just that all night," she said. "I have terrific presentiments about things sometimes. I'll never travel on a rapide again at night. There must be other comfortable trains that don't go so fast."
Then the train was in the dark of the Gare de Lyon, and then stopped and porters came up to the windows. I handed bags through the windows, and we were out on the dim longness of the platform. And the American lady put herself in charge of one of the three men from Cook's, who said,
"Just a moment, madame, and I'll look for your name."
The porter brought a truck and piled on the baggage, and my wife said goodbye, and I said goodbye to the American lady, whose name had been found by the man from Cook's on a typewritten page and a sheaf of typewritten pages which he replaced in his pocket. We followed the porter with the truck down the long cement platform beside the train. At the end was a gate, and a man took the tickets. We were returning to Paris to set up separate residences.
An Alpine Idyll. It was hot coming down into the valley even in the early morning. The sun melted the snow from the skis we were carrying and dried the wood. It was spring in the valley, but the sun was very hot. We came along the road into Galtier carrying our skis and rucksacks. As we passed the churchyard, a burial was just over. I said Gruß Gott to the priest as he walked past us coming out of the churchyard. The priest bowed.
"It's funny a priest never speaks to you," John said.
"You'd think they'd like to say Gruß Gott."
"They never answer," John said. We stopped in the road and watched the sexton shoveling in the new earth. A peasant with a black beard and high leather boots stood beside the grave. The sexton stopped shoveling and straightened his back. The peasant in the high boots took the spade from the sexton and went on filling in the grave, spreading the earth evenly as a man spreading manure in a garden. In the bright May morning, the grave filling looked unreal. I could not imagine anyone being dead. "Imagine being buried on a day like this," I said to John. "I wouldn't like it." "Well," I said, "we don't have to do it." We went on up the road past the houses of the town to the inn. We had been skiing in the Silvretta for a month, and it was good to be down in the valley. In the Silvretta, the skiing had been all right, but it was spring skiing. The snow was good only in the early morning and again in the evening. The rest of the time it was spoiled by the sun. We were both tired of the sun. You could not get away from the sun. The only shadows were made by rocks or by the hut that was built under the protection of a rock beside a glacier, and in the shade the sweat froze in your underclothing. You could not sit outside the hut without dark glasses. It was pleasant to be burned black, but the sun had been very tiring. You could not rest in it. I was glad to be down, away from the snow. It was too late in the spring to be up in the Silvretta. I was a little tired of skiing. We had stayed too long. I could taste the snow water we had been drinking melted off the tin roof of the hut. The taste was a part of the way I felt about skiing. I was glad there were other things besides skiing, and I was glad to be down away from the unnatural high mountain spring into this May morning in the valley. The innkeeper sat on the porch of the inn, his chair tipped back against the wall. Beside him sat the cook.
"Ski heil," said the innkeeper.
"Heil," we said, and leaned the skis against the wall and took off our packs.
"How was it up above?" asked the innkeeper.
"Schön. A little too much sun."
"Yes, there's too much sun this time of year."
The cook sat on in his chair. The innkeeper went in with us and unlocked his office and brought out our mail. There was a bundle of letters and some papers.
"Let's get some beer," John said.
"Good. We'll drink it inside." The proprietor brought two bottles, and we drank them while we read the letters.
"We better have some more beer," John said.
A girl brought it this time. She smiled as she opened the bottles.
"Many letters," she said.
"Yes, many."
"Prost,"
she said, and went out, taking the empty bottles. I'd forgotten what beer tasted like.
"I hadn't," John said. "Up in the hut, I used to think about it a lot."
"Well," I said, "we've got it now."
"You oughtn't to ever do anything too long."
"No, we were up there too long."
"Too damn long," John said. "It's no good doing a thing too long."
The sun came through the open window and shone through the beer bottles on the table. The bottles were half full. There was a little froth on the beer in the bottles, not much because it was very cold. It collared up when you poured it into the tall glasses. I looked out of the open window at the white road. The trees beside the road were dusty. Beyond was a green field and a stream. There were trees along the stream and a mill with a water wheel. Through the open side of the mill, I saw a long log and a saw in it rising and falling. No one seemed to be tending it. There were four crows walking in the green field. One crow sat in a tree watching. Outside on the porch, the cook got off his chair and passed into the hall that led back into the kitchen. Inside, the sunlight shone through the empty glasses on the table. John was leaning forward with his head on his arms. Through the window, I saw two men come up the front steps. They came into the drinking room. One was the bearded peasant in the high boots. The other was the sexton. They sat down at the table under the window. The girl came in and stood by their table. The peasant did not seem to see her. He sat with his hands on the table. He wore his old army clothes. There were patches on the elbows.
"What will it be?"
asked the sexton. The peasant did not pay any attention.
"What will you drink?"
"Schnapps," the peasant said.
"And a quarter liter of red wine,"
the sexton told the girl. The girl brought the drinks, and the peasant drank the schnapps.
He looked out of the window. The sexton watched him. John had his head forward on the table. He was asleep. The innkeeper came in and went over to the table. He spoke in dialect, and the sexton answered him. The peasant looked out of the window. The innkeeper went out of the room. The peasant stood up. He took a folded 10,000-kronen note out of a leather pocketbook and unfolded it. The girl came up.
Alles?
She asked.
Alles, he said.
Let me buy the wine, the sexton said.
Alles,
the peasant repeated to the girl. She put her hand in the pocket of her apron, brought it out full of coins, and counted out the change. The peasant went out the door. As soon as he was gone, the innkeeper came into the room again and spoke to the sexton. He sat down at the table. They talked in dialect. The sexton was amused. The innkeeper was disgusted. The sexton stood up from the table. He was a little man with a mustache. He leaned out of the window and looked up the road.
There he goes in, he said.
In the Leuven?
Yeah.
They talked again, and then the innkeeper came over to our table. The innkeeper was a tall man and old. He looked at John asleep.
He's pretty tired.
Yes, we were up early.
Will you want to eat soon?
Any time, I said. What is there to eat?
Anything you want. The girl will bring the eating card.
The girl brought the menu. John woke up. The menu was written in ink on a card, and the card slipped into a wooden paddle. There's the Speisekarte, I said to John. He looked at it. He was still sleepy. Won't you have a drink with us? I said to the innkeeper. He sat down.
Those peasants are beasts, said the innkeeper.
We saw that one at a funeral coming into town.
That was his wife.
Oh,
he's a beast. All these peasants are beasts.
How do you mean?
You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe what just happened about that one.
Tell me.
You wouldn't believe it.
The innkeeper spoke to the sexton.
Franz, come over here.
The sexton came, bringing his little bottle of wine and his glass.
The gentlemen are just coming down from the Wiesbadener Hütte,
the innkeeper said. We shook hands.
What will you drink? I asked.
Nothing.
Franz shook his finger. Another quarter liter?
All right.
Do you understand dialect?
The innkeeper asked.
No.
What's it all about?
John asked. He's going to tell us about the peasant we saw filling the grave coming into town.
I can't understand it anyway, John said. It goes too fast for me. That peasant, the innkeeper said. Today he brought his wife to be buried. She died last November.
December, said the sexton.
That makes nothing. She died last December, then, and he notified the commune.
December 18th,
said the sexton.
Anyway, he couldn't bring her over to be buried until the snow was gone.
He lives on the other side of the Petsnon, said the sexton, but he belongs to this parish.
He couldn't bring her out at all? I asked.
No, he can only come from where he lives on skis until the snow melts. So today he brought her in to be buried, and the priest, when he looked at her face, didn't want to bury her. You go on and tell it, he said to the sexton. Speak German, not dialect. It was very funny with the priest, said the sexton. In the report to the commune, she died of heart trouble. We knew she had heart trouble here. She used to faint in church sometimes. She did not come for a long time. She wasn't strong to climb. When the priest uncovered her face, he asked Ols, did your wife suffer much? No, said Ols. When I came in the house, she was dead across the bed. The priest looked at her again. He didn't like it. How did her face get that way? I don't know, Ols said. You'd better find out, the priest said, and put the blanket back. Ols didn't say anything. The priest looked at him. Ols looked back at the priest. You want to know? I must know, the priest said. This is where it's good, the innkeeper said. Listen to this. Go on, Franz.
Well, said Olds, when she died, I made the report to the commune, and I put her in the shed across the top of the big wood. When I started to use the big wood, she was stiff, and I put her up against the wall. Her mouth was open, and when I came into the shed at night to cut up the big wood, I hung the lantern from it.
Why did you do that? Asked the priest.
I don't know, said Ols.
Did you do that many times?
Every time I went to work in the shed at night. It was very wrong, said the priest. Did you love your wife?
Yeah, I loved her, Ols said. I loved her fine.
Did you understand it all? Asked the innkeeper. You understand it all about his wife?
I heard it. How about eating? John asked. You order, I said.
Do you think it's true? I asked the innkeeper.
Sure it's true, he said. These peasants are beasts.
Where did he go now?
He's gone to drink at my colleague's, the Leuven.
He didn't want to drink with me, said the sexton.
He didn't want to drink with me after he knew about his wife, said the innkeeper.
Say, said John, how about eating?
All right, I said.
A pursuit race. William Campbell had been in a pursuit race with a burlesque show ever since Pittsburgh. In a pursuit race, in bicycle racing, riders start at equal intervals to ride after one another. They ride very fast because the race is usually limited to a short distance, and if they slow their riding, another rider who maintains his pace will make up the space that separated them equally at the start. As soon as a rider is caught and passed, he is out of the race and must get down from his bicycle and leave the track. If none of the riders are caught, the winner of the race is the one who has gained the most distance. In most pursuit races, if there are only two riders, one of the riders is caught inside of 6 miles. The burlesque show caught William Campbell at Kansas City. William Campbell had hoped to hold a slight lead over the burlesque show until they reached the Pacific coast. As long as he preceded the burlesque show as advance man, he was being paid. When the burlesque show caught up with him, he was in bed. He was in bed when the manager of the burlesque troupe came into his room, and after the manager had gone out, he decided that he might as well stay in bed. It was very cold in Kansas City, and he was in no hurry to go out. He did not like Kansas City. He reached under the bed for a bottle and drank. It made his stomach feel better. Mr. Turner, the manager of the burlesque show, had refused a drink. William Campbell's interview with Mr. Turner had been a little strange. Mr. Turner had knocked on the door. Campbell had said, "Come in." When Mr. Turner came into the room, he saw clothing on a chair, an open suitcase, the bottle on a chair beside the bed, and someone lying in the bed completely covered by the bedclothes.
"Mr. Campbell," Mr. Turner said.
"You can't fire me," William Campbell said from underneath the covers. It was warm and white and close under the covers. "You can't fire me, because I've got down off my bicycle."
"You're drunk," Mr. Turner said.
"Oh, yes,"
William Campbell said, speaking directly against the sheet and feeling the texture with his lips. "You're a fool," Mr. Turner said. He turned off the electric light. The electric light had been burning all night. It was now 10 o'clock in the morning.
"You're a drunken fool. When did you get into this town?"
"I got into this town last night," William Campbell said, speaking against the sheet.
He found he liked to talk through a sheet.
"Did you ever talk through a sheet?"
"Don't try to be funny. You aren't funny."
"I'm not being funny. I'm just talking through a sheet."
"You're talking through a sheet, all right."
"You can go now, Mr. Turner," Campbell said. "I don't work for you anymore."
"You know that anyway."
"I know a lot,"
William Campbell said. He pulled down the sheet and looked at Mr. Turner.
"I know enough so I don't mind looking at you at all. Do you want to hear what I know?"
"No."
"Good," said William Campbell.
"Because really, I don't know anything at all. I was just talking."
He pulled the sheet up over his face again.
I love it under a sheet, he said.
Mr. Turner stood beside the bed. He was a middle-aged man with a large stomach and a bald head, and he had many things to do.
You want to stop off here, Billy, and take a cure, he said. I'll fix it up if you want to do it.
I don't want to take a cure, William Campbell said. I don't want to take a cure at all. I am perfectly happy. All my life I have been perfectly happy.
How long have you been this way?
What a question.
William Campbell breathed in and out through the sheet. How long have you been stewed, Billy?
Haven't I done my work?
Sure. I just asked you how long you've been stewed, Billy.
I don't know.
But I've got my wolf back. He touched the sheet with his tongue.
I've had him for a week.
The hell you have.
Oh, yes. My dear wolf. Every time I take a drink, he goes outside the room. He can't stand alcohol. The poor little fellow.
He moved his tongue round and round on the sheet.
He's a lovely wolf. He's just like he always was.
William Campbell shut his eyes and took a deep breath.
You got to take a cure, Billy, Mr. Turner said. You won't mind the Keeley. It isn't bad.
The Keeley, William Campbell said.
It isn't far from London.
He shut his eyes and opened them, moving the eyelashes against the sheet.
I just love sheets, he said.
He looked at Mr. Turner.
Listen, you think I'm drunk.
You are drunk.
No, I'm not.
You're drunk and you've had DTs.
No.
William Campbell held the sheet around his head.
Dear sheet, he said.
He breathed against it gently.
Pretty sheet. You love me, don't you, sheet? It's all in the price of the room, just like in Japan. No, he said. Listen, Billy. Dear sliding Billy, I have a surprise for you. I'm not drunk. I'm hopped to the eyes.
No, said Mr. Turner.
Take a look.
William Campbell pulled up the right sleeve of his pajama jacket under the sheet, then shoved the right forearm out.
Look at that.
On the forearm, from just above the wrist to the elbow, were small blue circles around tiny dark blue punctures. The circles almost touched one another.
That's a new development, William Campbell said. I drink a little now once in a while, just to drive the wolf out of the room.
They got a cure for that,
sliding Billy Turner said.
No, William Campbell said. They haven't got a cure for anything.
You can't just quit like that, Billy, Turner said.
He sat on the bed.
Be careful of my sheet, William Campbell said.
You can't just quit at your age and take to pumping yourself full of that stuff just because you got in a jam.
There's a law against it,
if that's what you mean.
No, I mean you gotta fight it out.
Billy Campbell caressed the sheet with his lips and his tongue.
Dear sheet, he said, I can kiss this sheet and see right through it at the same time.
Cut it out about the sheet. You can't just take to that stuff, Billy.
William Campbell shut his eyes. He was beginning to feel a slight nausea. He knew that this nausea would increase steadily without there ever being the relief of sickness until something were done against it. It was at this point that he suggested that Mr. Turner have a drink. Mr. Turner declined. William Campbell took a drink from the bottle. It was a temporary measure. Mr. Turner watched him. Mr. Turner had been in this room much longer than he should have been. He had many things to do. Although living in daily association with people who used drugs, he had a horror of drugs. And he was very fond of William Campbell. He did not wish to leave him. He was very sorry for him, and he felt a cure might help. He knew there were good cures in Kansas City, but he had to go. He stood up.
Listen, Billy, William Campbell said. I want to tell you something. You're called Sliding Billy. That's because you can slide.
I'm called just Billy. That's because I never could slide at all.
I can't slide, Billy.
I can't slide. It just catches. Every time I try it, it catches.
He shut his eyes.
I can't slide, Billy. It's awful when you can't slide.
Yes, said Sliding Billy Turner.
Yes, what?
William Campbell looked at him. You were saying.
No, said William Campbell. I wasn't saying. It must have been a mistake.
You were saying about sliding.
No, it couldn't have been about sliding. But listen, Billy, I'll tell you a secret. Stick to sheets, Billy. Keep away from women and horses and...
He stopped.
Eagles, Billy. If you love horses, you'll get horses. And if you love eagles, you'll get eagles.
He stopped and put his head under the sheet.
I got to go, said Sliding Billy Turner.
If you love women, you'll get a dose, William Campbell said. If you love horses...
Yes, you said that.
Said what?
About horses and eagles.
Oh, yes. And if you love sheets...
He breathed on the sheet and stroked his nose against it.
I don't know about sheets, he said. I just started to love this sheet.
I have to go, Mr. Turner said. I got a lot to do.
That's all right,
William Campbell said.
Everybody's got to go.
I better go.
All right, you go.
Are you all right, Billy?
I was never so happy in my life.
And you're all right?
I'm fine. You go along. I'll just lie here for a little while. Around noon, I'll get up.
But when Mr. Turner came up to William Campbell's room at noon, William Campbell was sleeping. And as Mr. Turner was a man who knew what things in life were very valuable, he did not wake him. Today is Friday. Three Roman soldiers are in a drinking place at 11 o'clock at night. There are barrels around the wall. Behind the wooden counter is a Hebrew wine cellar. The three Roman soldiers are a little cockeyed.
You tried the red? No, I ain't tried it.
You better try it.
All right, George. We'll have a round of the red.
Here you are, gentlemen. You'll like that.
He sets down an earthenware pitcher that he has filled from one of the casks.
That's a nice little wine.
Have a drink of it yourself.
He turns to the third Roman soldier who is leaning on a barrel.
What's the matter with you?
I got a gut ache.
You've been drinking water. Try some of the red.
I can't drink the damn stuff. It makes my gut sour.
You've been out here too long.
Hell, don't I know it?
Say, George, can't you give this gentleman something to fix up his stomach?
I got it right here.
The third Roman soldier tastes the cup that the wine cellar has mixed for him.
Hey, what'd you put in that, camel chips?
You drink that right down, Lieutenant. That'll fix you right up.
Well, I couldn't feel any worse.
Take a chance on it.
George fixed me up fine the other day.
You were in bad shape, Lieutenant. I know what fixes up a bad stomach.
The third Roman soldier drinks the cup down.
Jesus Christ.
That false alarm.
Oh, I don't know. He was pretty good in there today.
Why didn't he come down off the cross?
He didn't want to come down off the cross. That's not his play.
Show me a guy that doesn't want to come down off the cross.
Oh, hell, you don't know anything about it. Ask George there. Did he want to come down off the cross, George?
I'll tell you, gentlemen, I wasn't there. It's a thing I haven't taken any interest in.
Listen, I seen a lot of them, here and plenty of other places. Anytime you show me one that doesn't want to get down off the cross when the time comes, I'll climb right up with him.
I thought he was pretty good in there today.
He was all right.
You guys don't know what I'm talking about. I'm not saying whether he was good or not. What I mean is when the time comes, when they first start nailing him, there is none of them wouldn't stop it if they could.
Didn't you follow it, George?
No, I don't take any interest in it, Lieutenant.
I was surprised how he acted.
The part I don't like is the nailing them on. You know, that must get to you pretty bad.
It isn't that that's so bad as when they first lift them up. When the weight starts to pull on them. That's when it gets them.
It takes some of them pretty bad.
Ain't I seen them? I seen plenty of them. I tell you, he was pretty good in there today.
The second Roman soldier smiles at the Hebrew wine cellar.
You're a regular Christer, big boy.
Sure, go on and kid him. But listen while I tell you something. He was pretty good in there today.
What about some more wine?
The wine cellar looks up expectantly. The third Roman soldier is sitting with his head down. He does not look well.
I don't want any more.
Just for two, George.
The wine cellar puts out a pitcher of wine, a size smaller than the last one. He leans forward on the wooden counter.
You see his girl?
Wasn't I standing right by her?
She's a nice looker.
I knew her before he did.
I used to see her around the town.
She used to have a lot of stuff.
He never brought her no good luck.
Oh, he ain't lucky.
But he looked pretty good to me in there today.
What become of his gang?
Oh, they faded out. Just the women stuck by him.
They were a pretty yellow crowd. When they seen him go up there, they didn't want any of it.
The women stuck all right.
Sure, they stuck all right.
You see me slip the old spear into him?
You'll get into trouble doing that someday.
It was the least I could do for him.
I tell you, he looked pretty good to me in there today.
Gentlemen, you know I got the clothes. We'll have one more round.
What's the use? This stuff don't get you anywhere. Come on, let's go.
Just another round.
No, come on. Let's go. I feel like hell tonight.
Just one more.
Nah, come on. We're going to go. Then I, George. Put it on the bill.
Good night, gentlemen. You couldn't let me have a little something on account, Lieutenant?
What the hell, George? Wednesday's payday.
It's all right, Lieutenant. Good night, gentlemen.
The three Roman soldiers go out the door into the street. Outside in the street.
George is a kike, just like all the rest of them.
Oh, George is a nice fella.
Everybody's a nice fella to you tonight.
Come on, let's go up to the barracks. I feel like hell tonight.
You been out here too long.
No, it ain't just that. I feel like hell.
You been out here too long. That's all.
Curtain. Banal story. So he ate an orange, slowly spitting out the seeds. Outside, the snow was turning to rain. Inside, the electric stove seemed to give no heat, and rising from his writing table, he sat down upon the stove. How good it felt. Here at last was life. He reached for another orange. Far away in Paris, Mascar had knocked Danny Frush cuckoo in the second round. Far off in Mesopotamia, 21 feet of snow had fallen. Across the world in distant Australia, the English cricketers were sharpening up their wickets. There was romance. Patrons of the arts and letters have discovered the Forum, he read. It is the guide, philosopher, and friend of the thinking minority. Prize short stories. Will their authors write our bestsellers of tomorrow? You will enjoy these warm, homespun American tales, bits of real life on the open ranch, in crowded tenement or comfortable home, and all with a healthy undercurrent of humor. I must read them, he thought. He read on. Our children's children, what of them? Who of them? New means must be discovered to find room for us under the sun. Shall this be done by war, or can it be done by peaceful methods? Or will we all have to move to Canada?
Our deepest convictions, will science upset them? Our civilization, is it inferior to older orders of things? And meanwhile, in the far-off dripping jungles of Yucatan, sounded the chopping of the axes of the gum choppers. Do we want big men, or do we want them cultured? Take Joyce. Take President Coolidge. What star must our college students aim at? There is Jack Britton. There is Dr. Henry Van Dyke. Can we reconcile the two? Take the case of young Stribling. And what of our daughters who must make their own soundings? Nancy Hawthorne is obliged to make her own soundings in the sea of life. Bravely and sensibly, she faces the problems which come to every girl of 18. It was a splendid booklet. Are you a girl of 18? Take the case of Joan of Arc. Take the case of Bernard Shaw. Take the case of Betsy Ross. Think of these things in 1925. Was there a risque page in Puritan history? Were there two sides to Pocahontas? Did he have a fourth dimension? Are modern paintings and poetry art? Yes and no. Take Picasso. Have tramps codes of conduct? Send your mind adventuring. There is romance everywhere. Forum writers talk to the point, are possessed of humor and wit, but they do not try to be smart and are never long-winded. Live the full life of the mind, exhilarated by new ideas, intoxicated by the romance of the unusual. He laid down the booklet. And meanwhile, stretched flat on a bed in a darkened room in his house in Triana, Manuel Garcia Mayra lay with a tube in each lung, drowning with the pneumonia. All the papers in Andalusia devoted special supplements to his death, which had been expected for some days. Men and boys bought full-length colored pictures of him to remember him by, and lost the picture they had of him in their memories by looking at the lithographs. Bullfighters were very relieved he was dead, because he did always in the bullring the things they could only do sometimes. They all marched in the rain behind his coffin, and there were 147 bullfighters followed him out to the cemetery, where they buried him in the tomb next to Joselito. After the funeral, everyone sat in the cafes out of the rain, and many colored pictures of Mayra were sold to men who rolled them up and put them away in their pockets. Now I lay me. That night we lay on the floor in the room, and I listened to the silkworms eating. The silkworms fed in racks of mulberry leaves, and all night you could hear them eating, and a dropping sound in the leaves. I myself did not want to sleep, because I had been living for a long time with the knowledge that if I ever shut my eyes in the dark and let myself go, my soul would go out of my body. I had been that way for a long time, ever since I had been blown up at night and felt it go out of me and go off and then come back. I tried never to think about it, but it had started to go since, in the nights, just at the moment of going off to sleep. And I could only stop it by a very great effort. So while now I am fairly sure that it would not really have gone out, yet then, that summer, I was unwilling to make the experiment. I had different ways of occupying myself while I lay awake. I would think of a trout stream I had fished along when I was a boy, and fish its whole length very carefully in my mind, fishing very carefully under all the logs, all the turns of the bank, the deep holes and the clear shallow stretches, sometimes catching trout and sometimes losing them. I would stop fishing at noon to eat my lunch, sometimes on a log over the stream, sometimes on a high bank under a tree. And I always ate my lunch very slowly and watched the stream below me while I ate. Often I ran out of bait because I would take only 10 worms with me in a tobacco tin when I started. When I had used them all, I had to find more worms, and sometimes it was very difficult digging in the bank of the stream where the cedar trees kept out the sun, and there was no grass but only the bare, moist earth, and often I could find no worms. Always, though, I found some kind of bait, but one time in the swamp I could find no bait at all, and had to cut up one of the trout I had caught and use him for bait. Sometimes I found insects in the swamp meadows, in the grass or under ferns, and used them. There were beetles and insects with legs like grass stems, and grubs in old rotten logs. White grubs with brown pinching heads that would not stay on the hook and emptied into nothing in the cold water. And wood ticks under logs where sometimes I found angleworms that slipped into the ground as soon as the log was raised. Once I used a salamander from under an old log. The salamander was very small and neat and agile and a lovely color. He had tiny feet that tried to hold on to the hook. And after that one time, I never used a salamander, although I found them very often. Nor did I use crickets, because of the way they acted about the hook. Sometimes the stream ran through an open meadow, and in the dry grass I would catch grasshoppers and use them for bait. And sometimes I would catch grasshoppers and toss them into the stream, and watch them float along, swimming on the stream, and circling on the surface as the current took them, and then disappear as a trout rose. Sometimes I would fish 4 or 5 different streams in the night, starting as near as I could get to their source and fishing them downstream. When I had finished too quickly and the time did not go, I would fish the stream over again, starting where it emptied into the lake and fishing back upstream, trying for all the trout I had missed coming down. Some nights, too, I made upstreams, and some of them were very exciting, and it was like being awake and dreaming. Some of those streams I still remember, and think that I have fished in them, and they are confused with streams I really know. I gave them all names, and went to them on the train, and sometimes walked for miles to get to them. But some nights I could not fish, and on those nights I was cold awake, and said my prayers over and over, and tried to pray for all the people I had ever known. That took up a great amount of time. For if you try to remember all the people you have ever known, going back to the earliest thing you remember, which was with me the attic of the house where I was born and my mother and father's wedding cake in a tin box hanging from one of the rafters, and in the attic jars of snakes and other specimens that my father had collected as a boy and preserved in alcohol, the alcohol sunken in the jars so the backs of some of the snakes and specimens were exposed and had turned white. If you thought back that far, you remembered a great many people. If you prayed for all of them, saying a Hail Mary and an Our Father for each one, it took a long time, and finally it would be light, and then you could go to sleep, if you were in a place where you could sleep in the daylight. On those nights I tried to remember everything that had ever happened to me, starting with just before I went to the war, and remembering back from one thing to another. I found I could only remember back to that attic in my grandfather's house. Then I would start there and remember this way again, until I reached the war. I remembered after my grandfather died, we moved away from that house and to a new house designed and built by my mother. Many things that were not to be moved were burned in the backyard, and I remember those jars from the attic being thrown in the fire, and how they popped in the heat, and the fire flamed up from the alcohol. I remember the snakes burning in the fire in the backyard. But there were no people in that, only things. I could not remember who burned the things even, and I would go on until I came to people, and then stop and pray for them. About the new house, I remembered how my mother was always cleaning things out and making a good clearance. One time when my father was away on a hunting trip, she made a good thorough cleaning out in the basement and burned everything that should not have been there. When my father came home and got down from his buggy and hitched the horse, the fire was still burning in the road beside the house. I went out to meet him. He handed me his shotgun and looked at the fire. "What's this?" he asked.
"I've been cleaning out the basement, dear," my mother said from the porch.
She was standing there smiling to meet him.
My father looked at the fire and kicked at something. Then he leaned over and picked something out of the ashes.
"Get a rake, Nick," he said to me.
I went to the basement and brought a rake, and my father raked very carefully in the ashes. He raked out stone axes and stone skinning knives and tools for making arrowheads and pieces of pottery and many arrowheads. They had all been blackened and chipped by the fire. My father raked them all out very carefully and spread them on the grass by the road. His shotgun in its leather case and his game bags were on the grass where he had left them when he stepped down from the buggy.
"Take the gun and the bags in the house, Nick, and bring me a paper," he said.
My mother had gone inside the house. I took the shotgun, which was heavy to carry, and banged against my legs, and the two game bags and started toward the house.
"Take them one at a time," my father said. "Don't try and carry too much at once."
I put down the game bags and took in the shotgun and brought out a newspaper from the pile in my father's office. My father spread all the blackened, chipped stone implements on the paper and then wrapped them up.
"The best arrowheads went all to pieces," he said.
He walked into the house with the paper package, and I stayed outside on the grass with the two game bags. After a while, I took them in. In remembering that, there were only two people, so I would pray for them both. Some nights, though, I could not remember my prayers even. I could only get as far as "on earth as it is in heaven," and then have to start all over and be absolutely unable to get past that. Then I would have to recognize that I could not remember and give up saying my prayers that night and try something else. So on some nights I would try to remember all the animals in the world by name, and then the birds, and then fishes, and then countries and cities, and then kinds of food, and the names of all the streets I could remember in Chicago, and when I could not remember anything at all anymore, I would just listen. And I do not remember a night on which you could not hear things. If I could have a light, I was not afraid to sleep, because I knew my soul would only go out of me if it were dark. So, of course, many nights I was where I could have a light, and then I slept, because I was nearly always tired and often very sleepy. And I am sure many times, too, that I slept without knowing it. But I never slept knowing it. And on this night, I listened to the silkworms. You can hear silkworms eating very clearly in the night. And I lay with my eyes open and listened to them. There was only one other person in the room, and he was awake, too. I listened to him being awake for a long time. He could not lie as quietly as I could because perhaps he had not had as much practice being awake. We were lying on blankets spread over straw, and when he moved, the straw was noisy. But the silkworms were not frightened by any noise we made and ate on steadily. There were the noises of night 7 kilometers behind the lines outside, but they were different from the small noises inside the room in the dark. The other man in the room tried lying quietly. Then he moved again. I moved too, so he would know I was awake. He had lived 10 years in Chicago. They had taken him for a soldier in 1914 when he had come back to visit his family, and they had given him to me for an orderly because he spoke English. I heard him listening, so I moved again in the blankets.
"Can't you sleep, Signor Tenente?" he asked.
"No.
I can't sleep either."
"What's the matter?"
"I don't know. I can't sleep."
"You feel all right?"
"Sure.
I feel good.
I just can't sleep."
"You want to talk for a while?" I asked.
"Sure. What can you talk about in this damn place?"
"This place is pretty good," I said.
"Sure," he said. "It's all right."
"Tell me about out in Chicago," I said.
"Oh," he said, "I told you all that once."
"Tell me about how you got married."
"I told you that."
"Was the letter you got Monday from her?"
"Sure. She writes me all the time.
She's making good money with the place.
You'll have a nice place when you go back.
Sure, she runs it fine. She's making a lot of money.
Don't you think we'll wake them up talking? I asked.
No, they can't hear. Anyway, they sleep like pigs. I'm different,
he said.
I'm nervous.
Talk quiet, I said. Want to smoke? We smoked skillfully in the dark.
You don't smoke much, Signor Tenente.
No, I've just about cut it out.
Well, he said, it don't do you any good. And I suppose you get so you don't miss it. Did you ever hear a blind man won't smoke because he can't see the smoke come out?
I don't believe it.
I think it's all bull myself, he said. I just heard it somewhere. You know how you hear things.
We were both quiet, and I listened to the silkworms.
You hear those damn silkworms?
He asked. You kind of hear them chew. It's funny, I said.
Say, Signor Tenente, is there something really the matter that you can't sleep? I never see you asleep. You haven't slept nights ever since I've been with you.
I don't know, John, I said. I got in pretty bad shape along early last spring, and at night it bothers me.
Just like I am, he said. I shouldn't have ever got in this war. I'm too nervous.
Maybe it will get better.
Say, Signor Tenente, what did you get in this war for, anyway?
I don't know, John. I wanted to, then.
Wanted to? He said. That's a hell of a reason.
We oughtn't to talk out loud, I said.
They sleep just like pigs, he said. They can't understand the English language anyway. They don't know a damn thing. What are you going to do when it's over, and we go back to the States?
I'll get a job on a paper.
In Chicago?
Maybe.
Do you ever read what this fellow Brisbane writes? My wife cuts it out for me and sends it to me.
Sure.
Did you ever meet him?
No, but I've seen him.
I'd like to meet that fellow. He's a fine writer. My wife don't read English, but she takes the paper just like when I was home, and she cuts out the editorials and the sports page and sends them to me.
How are your kids?
They're fine. One of the girls is in the fourth grade now. You know, Signor Tenente, if I didn't have the kids, I wouldn't be your orderly now. They'd have made me stay in the line all the time.
I'm glad you've got them.
So am I. They're fine kids. But I want a boy. 3 girls and no boy. That's a hell of a note.
Why don't you try and go to sleep?
No, I can't sleep now. I'm wide awake now, Signor Tenente. Say, I'm worried about you not sleeping, though.
It'll be all right, John.
Imagine a young fellow like you not to sleep.
I'll get all right. It just takes a while.
You got to get all right. A man can't get along that don't sleep. Do you worry about anything? You got anything on your mind?
No, John, I don't think so.
You ought to get married, Signor Tenente. Then you wouldn't worry.
I don't know.
You ought to get married. Why don't you pick out some nice Italian girl with plenty of money? You could get anyone you want. You're young and you got good decorations and you look nice. You've been wounded a couple of times.
I can't talk the language well enough.
You talk it fine. To hell with talking the language. You don't have to talk to them. Marry them.
I'll think about it.
You know some girls, don't you?
Sure.
Well, you marry the one with the most money. Over here, the way they're brought up, they'll all make you a good wife.
I'll think about it.
Don't think about it, Signor Tenente. Do it.
All right.
A man ought to be married. You'll never regret it.
Every man ought to be married.
All right, I said. Let's try and sleep a while.
All right, Signor Tenente. I'll try it again. But you remember what I said.
I'll remember it, I said. Now let's sleep a while, John.
All right, he said. I hope you sleep, Signor Tenente.
I heard him roll in his blankets on the straw, and then he was very quiet, and I listened to him breathing regularly. Then he started to snore. I listened to him snore for a long time, and then I stopped listening to him snore and listened to the silkworms eating. They ate steadily, making a dropping in the leaves. I had a new thing to think about, and I lay in the dark with my eyes open and thought of all the girls I had ever known and what kind of wives they would make. It was a very interesting thing to think about, and for a while it killed off trout fishing and interfered with my prayers. Finally, though, I went back to trout fishing because I found that I could remember all the streams, and there was always something new about them. While the girls, after I had thought about them a few times, blurred and I could not call them into my mind. And finally, they all blurred and all became rather the same, and I gave up thinking about them almost altogether. But I kept on with my prayers, and I prayed very often for John in the nights, and his class was removed from active service before the October offensive. I was glad he was not there, because he would have been a great worry to me. He came to the hospital in Milan to see me several months after, and was very disappointed that I had not yet married. And I know he would feel very badly if he knew that, so far, I have never married. He was going back to America, and he was very certain about marriage, and knew it would fix up everything.
Biography of Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway, 1899 to 1961, was one of the most influential writers and larger-than-life characters of the first half of the 20th century, a renowned outdoorsman, journalist, and for a time, European expatriate. Hemingway began life as a reporter, and his just-the-facts style of writing for newspapers, unadorned and direct, became the signature style he employed in his stories and novels. Born and raised in Oak Park, Illinois, Hemingway was a star athlete who also wrote for the school newspaper and yearbook. Upon graduation in 1917, he worked briefly as a cub reporter for the Kansas City Star, but soon afterwards tried to enlist in the Army. After he was rejected for poor eyesight, he happened upon a Red Cross notice enticing young men to become ambulance drivers in Europe and immediately signed up. Shipped to the Italian front, Hemingway arrived at the front lines in June of 1918. Within a month, he would be seriously injured by mortar fire and hospitalized in Milan, but not before assisting some wounded Italian soldiers to safety and being awarded the Italian Silver Medal of Military Valor for his heroism. While recuperating in Milan, he fell in love with a Red Cross nurse, Agnes von Karowski, who was 7 years his senior. When he returned to America, he hoped Agnes would join him, but she broke his heart by becoming engaged to an Italian officer. He would later use his wartime experience as the basis for his book, A Farewell to Arms. Working briefly as a journalist in Toronto and Chicago, Hemingway met his first wife, Hadley Richardson. The two married in 1921 and thereafter left for Paris, Hemingway working as a foreign correspondent for the Toronto Star. While in Paris, Hemingway fell in with a group of artists who had taken up residence in the city, including James Joyce, Ezra Pound, Pablo Picasso, Joan Miró, and the woman who would become his friend and mentor until they had a famous falling out, Gertrude Stein. While in Paris, Hemingway kept busy writing for the Star and penning his own short stories, which he collected into two books, 3 Stories and 10 Poems, and In Our Time. Hemingway also met F. Scott Fitzgerald in Paris, and Fitzgerald's publication of The Great Gatsby in 1927 convinced Hemingway that he should move on from writing short stories and embark on a novel. His trip to Pamplona, Spain, and subsequent fascination with bullfighting led to his creation of his first full book, The Sun Also Rises. During this time, he and Hadley had a son, Jack, but when Hemingway began an affair with Pauline Pfeiffer, Hadley and Hemingway separated. Hemingway married Pauline that same year. After Pauline became pregnant with Hemingway's second son, Patrick, the couple moved to Key West, Florida, where Hemingway would complete The Sun Also Rises, To Have and Have Not, and a number of additional short stories. They had another son, Gregory, in 1931, but divorced in 1940 after Hemingway commenced an affair with writer Martha Gellhorn, who soon became his third wife. Living briefly in Cuba and covering World War II from Europe towards the end of the war, Hemingway divorced a third time and married Mary Welsh. Oddly, the couple each suffered a series of painful and debilitating accidents, Hemingway being injured and almost dying in not one but two plane crashes in a single year. During this turbulent period, he wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, which was a literary sensation, and began work on The Old Man and the Sea, which later became his most popular work. Looking for a place to settle down, he and Mary established a permanent residence in Ketchum, Idaho. In 1954, Hemingway was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. 2 years later, on a trip to Paris, he discovered a trove of early writings in a lost trunk, and later published them under the title A Movable Feast. Hemingway's health and mental status began to rapidly deteriorate in the late 1950s, and while he continued to write, his mental decline and physical challenges proved to be too much for him to bear. On July 2, 1961, Hemingway took up his favorite shotgun, put it to his head, and ended his life. Ernest Hemingway was a dominant figure in American literature during his lifetime, and his influence on the writers who followed him, both positive and negative, lasts to this day.
This has been Men Without Women, written by Ernest Hemingway, narrated by Joseph Wyckoff. Copyright 2023 by Fort Rafael Publishing Company. Production copyright 2023, Soundcraft Audiobooks.